Hello. On this week's program, we remember Thomas Chimes, who died this week, aged 88. He was one of Philadelphia's most highly regarded and respected contemporary artists. Jason Pfeiffer delves into the history of tattoos and body art with a visit to a new exhibition at the Independent Seaport Museum. We listen again as Susan Lewis visits Cézanne and Beyond at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns looks at Fantasy Made Real in new presentations by the Opera Company of Philadelphia and theatre company Ego Poe Productions. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Thomas Chimes was born in Philadelphia in 1921. In 1939, he enrolled at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, but his studies were quickly interrupted by World War II. After the war, he studied philosophy and painting and sculpture in New York City under the GI Bill. In 1953, Chimes returned to Philadelphia, much to the bewilderment of many of his colleagues in New York. Inspired by notable Philadelphia artists and writers like Thomas Eakins and Edgar Allan Poe, he began to formulate an intensely personal and highly original iconography that often drew upon childhood memories and dreams. When a 10-year-old Thomas Chimes first visited the Philadelphia Museum of Art in 1931, he and his younger brothers were thrown out for showing disrespect towards the art. Over 75 years later, Chimes would be the reason for many people to visit the museum for a major retrospective of his work. A rare honour for a living artist, even more so for a local one. I spoke with Thomas Chimes as that show opened in early 2007. Tell me about your process. Is it a case of rising at an exact time every morning and going to the studio and having a set of almost rituals that you go through to get yourself to the place where it flows, or is it something much more esoteric?
The process, to me, is something like this. Since I know that the conscious mind is founded upon the unconscious mind. I know that as an intellectual idea. And the fact that I remember dreams very well, when I get up in the morning, I am not completely in the conscious state. I think everybody recognizes that. A kind of grogginess lingers with you. But the interesting thing, you're bringing part of the unconscious with you. So what do? Getting out of bed, I walk right over to the thing I was working on the evening before, and I know immediately what the next step must be. Because obviously, during the night, I process it. And I would look and say, oh, I've got to move that over, adjust that, and so forth and so on. And that works day by day. And so I work every day, every day. It's not something that I have to be in the mood for anymore. The need to respond to what the unconscious is doing during the night is, at this stage, particularly, I'm going to be 86 in April, is vital. It's important that I deal with this because I'm dealing with something I'm not fully aware of what the meaning is.
Do you fear the end of your life?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
What's after this manifestation of your spirit or your soul?
I think we come from somewhere and we return to someplace. Everything comes out of the earth and everything is completed back in the earth.
Over the course of this more than 50-year-long career, you've created hundreds, if not thousands, of works of art. When you look back at this retrospective as it hangs here or as it's installed here at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, do you recognize the man who made a lot of those works?
The best way to answer that is yes and no. And I'll give you an example of the no part. I was called by the one who owns one of the pieces in the show on the phone and said, there's a piece of yours at the auction house, and I'm going down to see about it. And so I said, when's the auction? He says, it's tomorrow morning, or very close by. I said, do you think if I went over there by the time the place closes, I'll be able to see? He said, yeah, we'll try it. So I went over and finally came up to it, And I look at it, and I said, I have no memory, absolutely none, of having ever done this. And then the next thought is, maybe I didn't do it. But whoever did do it is a pretty good good artist, a good technician. I said, it's well done, but I don't recognize. If it's a fake, it was well done. But that sort of answers your question.
It was yours, I take it.
It was mine.
Thomas Chimes. He died peacefully among family on his 88th birthday on Monday.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Tattoos are pretty common today. They adorn athletes, bikers, movie stars, soccer moms, even Barbie dolls. But in the United States, this body art hasn't always been so ubiquitous. This weekend, the Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia opens a new exhibition that explores the traditions and development of tattooing in America. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports, the show provides a rare and detailed look at the role of tattoos in maritime culture.
Tattooing is not new. Using needles and ink to create permanent marks on the human skin has been practiced in cultures around the world for thousands of years. In some cultures, tattoos have long had religious significance, while others treat it more as decoration. There are more sinister chapters in history with tattooing, when permanent marks were used to identify persecuted groups, prisoners, and slaves. Tattoos have also had a special relationship with the sea, or at least those living on it. Craig Bruns conceived and researched the Independent Seaport Museum's new show, Skin and Bones, Tattoos in the Life of the American Sailor. Inspired by tattoo design samples, called Flash, that have long been part of the museum's collection, Bruns created the exhibit to examine the origins of tattooing in the United States. While tattoos have been around for many centuries, Bruns says American traditions of the body art began with British seafarers in the 1700s.
During the Revolutionary War and the colonial period, of course, there wasn't really an America, so British sailors had a long tradition. And for much of the early American Republic, sailors were the only individuals with tattoos.
The men picked up tattooing traditions as they visited the South Pacific Islands, Mediterranean cultures, and other parts of the world. In some ways, the indelible markings were souvenirs, but Craig Bruns says they were much more than that. Tattoos represented the unique sailor life on the sea.
They had a whole separate culture, and tattoos were the things that signified them visually from others. Tattoos were like guild symbols. Various craft guilds had their aprons or their symbols, while sailors had their tattoos.
Seafarers continue to carry on these traditions of tattooing. Skin and Bones includes Popeye the Sailor Man's tattoos and a Norman Rockwell image of a sailor getting inked, and actual sailors talk on film about the personal significance of their markings.
Basically, all the tattoos I have represent some part of me, whether my personality or anything I've been through or anything that I'm trying to become.
To be sure, not all sailors have tattoos these days, but the body art continues to hold deep meaning for many. Philadelphia native Richard Sam Benedetto has been in the Coast Guard for 18 years. His body is covered with dozens of tattoos. He's not exactly sure how many. He stopped counting at 54. According to Sam Benedetto, tattoos have long signified a rite of passage among sailors, helping to create strong relational bonds.
Only so many people can experience what 50-foot seas are like getting to it in the equator when you go through the Panama Canal, when you sail around the Horn. There's certain crossings. Each sailor goes through a rite of passage, and to now be associated with it, you know, sometimes they might tattoo an anchor. You sail in the Atlantic, swallows for 5,000 miles at sea. They will tattoo that on them, and that's where the brotherhood comes in.
In a large photograph at the Seaport Museum, visitors can get a look at Sam Benedetto's feet. A pig is tattooed on the left foot and a rooster on the right. Sam Benedetto says the animals demonstrate how superstition also plays a part in sailor tattoo traditions.
Two things I've heard at sea, these animals don't swim and they want to get you back safe. So you tattoo rooster on the right, pig on the left, and they'll get you there. The other one is that they kept these animals in crates, and when the ships sank, these crates floated free, and they were the survivors of a shipwreck. So superstitious, hey, they're on my feet. I'm still here today, and I've been through a lot.
Life on the sea is hard. Craig Bruns says historically, sailors didn't have many possessions or personal space, no place to hang a picture or decorate.
But you did have your body, and so you could carry those images with you. Images of good luck, images to identify yourself, images to remember loved ones.
Inspired by their experiences at sea, sailors started, in large part, the tattooing trade in America.
When you have the needle on there, it actually, this is what it sounds like when you're tattooing.
Edward Denny, also known as Sailor Eddie, is a Philadelphia-based tattooist. Sitting in his tattoo parlor at 2nd Street and Girard Avenue, he explains that his grandmother and grandfather started tattooing in 1933, and he began giving tattoos in their shop when he was 8 years old.
What I remember as a kid, up until when the Navy Yard closed, I remember sailors, it was a big part of our business.
And the early tattooists in the United States were usually sailors, setting up shop in port towns like Philadelphia, San Francisco, Norfolk, and Seattle. Ex-sailors and traveling carnivals helped bring tattooing traditions to Middle America, yet Sailor Eddie says the imprint of sailor culture remained.
It defined a style, and it was mandated because of the liberties and people being on leave, and they'd come into port, and you had to do a tattoo really fast because they got paid on the 1st and the 15th. You wanted to get them before their money ran out. So you had to get them on, do good work, and do it as fast as you could to get to the next guy. And that is what defined what is known as the traditional style of tattooing.
Okay. How would you describe that traditional style in terms of the aesthetics of it?
It's a bold outline with a lot of black shading and only three or four solid colors.
The basic elements of tattooing haven't changed much since Samuel O'Reilly invented the electric tattoo machine in 1891. But tattoos have become more detailed, nuanced in shading, and even abstract as new generations take on the craft. Nick Schoenberger, a Philadelphia-based tattoo scholar, says the popularity of body art has ebbed and flowed in the United States for hundreds of years, pointing to the subcultures of hip-hop, bikers, punks, gangs, and sailors. He believes the practice is rooted in the desire to be associated with other people or an idea.
Primarily, I think it's always about group identity and the individual within that group.
But Schoenberger admits that as tattoos become more socially acceptable in mainstream culture, increasingly etched on more visible body parts, body art is becoming less about group identity.
Now is the first time since maybe the early 1900s, 19-teens, where tattooing is also fashionable.
A fashion that in American culture can be credited to sailors. From colonial times until today, their tattooing customs remain unbroken, sustained by camaraderie, superstition, and memory. This ancient art form continues to grow and evolve as it reflects and projects identity on the sea, in the playing field, or at the mall.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Skin and Bones, Tattoos and the Life of the American Sailor is at the Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia through January. The Philadelphia region is home to more of the works of Paul Cézanne than anywhere else in the world. In the summer of 1996, the Philadelphia Museum of Art's retrospective on Cézanne broke museum attendance and sales records with over 548,000 visitors. While that exhibition focused on 170 works by the 19th century French painter, the show currently at the museum celebrates the impact of Cézanne, both on his peers and the generations that followed. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores Cézanne and beyond.
Cézanne's 1885 oil on canvas, The Bather, is among the first works to greet visitors at the show. On a canvas over 4 feet tall, a lean young man in a small swimsuit looks down at the sand, hands resting on his hips, his muscular left leg taking a step forward. But shift to the side and look beyond the gallery wall. A Picasso's Bather is visible in the room up ahead. An angular sculpture, the arms set on the hips, appears to mirror the Bather of Cézanne. Joe Rischel, the museum's curator of European painting before 1900, says the experience of this show is one of ongoing visual discovery.
There's tons of information. There's a 600-page book to use. There's an acoustic guide. There are labels. But finally, making the relationships, getting into the conversations is the important thing.
And part of the fun of Cézanne and Beyond, which explores not just the French master, but the artists who came after, and the connections between them all. Cézanne himself has been alternately described as impressionist, post-impressionist, the father of modern painting, and the bridge between impressionism and cubism, Although in the 1860s and 70s, he was part of the group of young painters who were bucking tradition, creating paintings with colorful little slaps or licks of paint, Joe Rischel says Cézanne rather quickly began painting in a way that set him apart from his Impressionist contemporaries.
Cézanne starts taking those dashes and putting them in a very structured, concrete, sort of bricklayer, he was called at the time, way of a lucid building of things that has less and less to do with immediate optical reality. If the Monet, the leaf, the wind picks up the leaf and catches the light, that's what he tells you about. Nothing ever moves in Cézanne. If you see a duck in the water in Cézanne, which you will on the occasion, that duck is stuck there for life.
Whether painting a fishing village, a collection of fruit, or a portrait of his wife, Cézanne's use of color, brushstrokes, and form were bold, overtaking perspective, creating images that didn't quite look like real life. This is not what the art establishment of the time regarded as fine art.
A picture like this would have been uncomfortable, as it may be still uncomfortable for people today because of the odd perspective.
Scott Schaefer is senior curator of paintings at the Getty Museum, which has loaned to this show an 1894 still life.
He shows a tabletop, piece of cloth, various ceramic vessels, as well as the apples falling out of the dish. The sense of disequilibrium that you feel standing in front of this picture is caused by the instability of the objects, which makes us slightly anxious when we look at a Cézanne still life.
And yet, by choosing not to replicate reality, Cézanne changed the idea of what a painting could be, says adjunct curator Kathy Sachs.
Painting was important in its own right. The work of art was a two-dimensional surface covered with paint. And Cézanne made us very aware of that. His foregrounds and backgrounds merge, and he actually creates an object that will therefore take you into the 21st century if you think about what kind of painting there is today.
In 1895, French dealer Ambroise Vollard mounted a one-person show of Cézanne's work, which drew artists like Matisse, Degas, Monet, Renoir, and Pizarro, a number of whom purchased paintings. In 1907, a year after Cézanne's death at age 67, a large show in Paris attracted people from all over Europe. And since then, artists have been crediting him with opening their eyes.
Picasso says Cézanne is the father of us all. Matisse says, if Cézanne's right, I'm right. And so it goes down to Jasper Johns or Ellsworth Kelly.
Bryce Martin called Cézanne my hero. And they each have a very personal response to Cézanne.
This exhibition of over 150 works is about one-third Cézanne, two-thirds work by 18 other artists from 9 different countries. The mostly paintings, but also sculpture and a couple of large photographs, are displayed in open, connected galleries, clustered thematically with at least one work by Cézanne close by to illustrate the ways the artists approached similar subjects. Take, for example, the large gallery space devoted to bathers, where two large Cézannes congregate with Picasso's bather sculptures in the center of the room and works by Matisse, Jasper Johns, and Bryce Martin on opposing walls.
You can see Picasso reacting to Cézanne's bathers, and you can see Jasper Johns reacting to Picasso's bathers, and that's what the show is all about, that domino effect. There is a diver figure in the Picasso bathers. There is a diver figure in the Jasper Johns fall.
Some references are explicit, as in Johns' tracing after Cézanne. Other connections are more subtle, like contemporary artist Bryce Martin's large abstract Red Rocks, in which wavy lines of color are set against a reddish-brown background. Kathy Sachs says the 21st century work was based on Martin's study of the large bathers from the National Gallery.
The proportions of the painting are exactly the same as the proportions of the National Gallery bather, but they are much larger. And during the whole time he was painting this series of paintings, he had a postcard of the National Gallery bather in his studio.
The variety of artistic and human responses to Cézanne illustrates his lasting power, says Joe Rischel.
For my generation, he was this titanic giant, John Wayne, chest-pounding, high testosteronic, sort of boom-boom, maker of monuments, you know, the great builder of absolute things. On the other side, I think Cézanne is a very funny, witty man of great sophistication. And I think what we try by putting him in different contexts in this to see how certain artists saw the wit.
Placed near Cézanne's famous painting of French country workmen playing cards is a nearly 4-foot square transparency and light box by Canadian artist Jeff Walls. also titled Card Players.
He literally gets actors and a built set and stages the card players, which is very funny because they're nice middle-aged ladies playing canasta.
Cézanne did not teach and became somewhat of a loner. He had a wife and son and worked much of his later life in his hometown region of Provence, but he remained driven in his work.
He wanted to be part of the grand destiny of art as he understood it.
He knew he was doing something different. I don't think he knew what it was. I don't think he knew where it would go or who would take it up and what would happen from there.
Cézanne's willingness to break with convention was clearly contagious, spreading throughout Europe and traveling across the Atlantic. And while Paul Cézanne may never have come to Philadelphia, he lives here nonetheless, in the high concentration of his works in the region and in shows like this one that celebrate those he's inspired for more than a century.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Cézanne and Beyond is now at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It runs through May 31st. Two such different performing arts organizations in Philadelphia have rarely landed in the same French symbolist dream world at the same time. But it's true. Ego Poe Productions, a cutting-edge theatre company, is producing the once popular, now neglected Maurice Maeterlinck play The Bluebird at the Mandel Theatre, while the Opera Company of Philadelphia is serving up Ravel's L'Enfant et les Sortilèges at the Academy of Music. And though the worse-than-usual budget constraints should make this a tough time for creating alternative worlds on stage, the use of computer animation, plus good old-fashioned theatrical resourcefulness, just might make this the best of times for both companies. Now the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stern surveys the landscape of both productions.
Fairy tales can often be judged by what comes out of the fireplace. Nothing so benign as Father Christmas comes down the chimney and into the world of L'Enfant et le Sortilège, or The Bluebird. In the latter play, a revolving diamond acts like an X-ray that reveals the dance, or in this case the dancer, behind the flames in the fireplace. At the Opera Company of Philadelphia, the character of fire resembles the sizzling Parisian nightclub star Josephine Baker. In these ever-rational times, it can be hard enough to convince some people that they themselves have a soul. But in these theater pieces, inanimate objects do indeed have souls that speak and sing. Ravel's version of fire gives aphoristic warnings like, "Be nice to the universe and it'll be nice to you." The question is how to make that work on stage. The answer for the Opera Company's Robert Driver is, don't take anything literally. Use computer animation and stay focused on what you want to see rather than the difficulties behind making that happen.
To me, it was somehow relieving to get away from the physicality of someone trying to be a chair and then just be that spirit of that chair attacking. It just released a whole different look, and I just felt, wow, that was so liberating. And, you know, here I was just asking for all of this stuff and thinking, oh, well, you know, just I want things leaving here, I want things leaving here. And as my wife would always say, you have no idea what you're asking for. You have no idea the work behind this. I said, well, it's not my problem.
The Ravel opera is ultimately a happy parable. Sure, the naughty child at the center of the plot gets kicked around a bit after all the animals and objects that he has abused start talking back to him. But such things unfold amid some of the best music written by one of the last century's greatest composers. But in Maeterlinck's Bluebird, as interpreted by Ego Poe, two small children venture into a forest that obviously represents their subconscious minds, having had their brothers and sisters claimed by death. They search for a healing bluebird to cure another child that's also on the way out. It's not about fearing death, but understanding it as another state of being, says director Lane Savadov. Past, present, and most spectacularly, the future, sometimes exist on the same stage.
Right there, you're looking at one of the acts of the play. That's the future unit. It's 13 steps. It looks like it's floating in space across the back psych. On each one of those is a baby in a blue christening gown, played by an actor. And they have these sort of magical blue sticks, and they are all creating inventions. They're about to be born. So it's the land of the children who are yet to be born. And they all have their destiny, which could be to create a new cure for a sickness, or it could be a sickness itself. One says, I'm bringing scarlet fever to the world. One's bringing a new weapon. And you can imagine 12 children up those steps sort of floating in space in these blue christening gowns, and the whole space is a video of rain at the time. So rain is just pouring past everybody, and the character of time is standing on the top in this sort of glowing archway, getting ready for these children to go through.
The production has four video sequences, one of which conveys what might normally be chaotic, expensive, and rather messy, an entire flock of bluebirds. Even such fantastical effects, however, are likely to be meaningless unless they touch on something elemental that can't be conveyed by representing a more typical reality. Bluebird is like the movie The Matrix, in that characters seem to be living in a dream, and The Sixth Sense, since they don't always know that they're dead. Visual images are suggested by tarot cards. Also on hand is Orchestra 2001, performing music by Philadelphia's great surrealist George Crumb, who also uses sounds suggesting eerie landscapes of the mind. And what about the people on stage? They have some special challenges. The opening lines of Bluebird were rehearsed for hours because they should reflect how characters are simultaneously dealing with their own dream worlds inside themselves in reaction to what they see outside themselves. Tricky. In the Ravel opera, baritone Marianne Popp is playing a cat doing a sexy apache dance that's so physical any tails or ears would get in the way, as well as a grandfather clock with a curious resemblance to Salvador Dali.
It's harder than the cat, because it's a very stiff object. So all the movements are mechanical, because it's a box. You know, it has to jump all the time from one side to the other. That, with the music, it's a very, very strong sport. You know, and the music is also pretty hard, so counting, it's always there. And actually, when I get out of the stage, I'm like, you know, grabbing for air.
Both directors, Robert Driver and Lane Savadov, tend to grimace at the mention of the most popular purveyors of fantasy, Disney. For years, the only way to encounter the Ravel opera was on recordings, such as this new one led by Simon Rattle, because no staging could live up to Disney. That was never the goal of the opera company's L'Enfant et le Sortilège, especially as the budget was cut from $250,000 to $150,000 in mid-season. Though Igor Poe put together a partnership with the Mandel Theater at Drexel University, the $120,000 budget is still on the low side for something with these kinds of ambitions. But no matter what the money looks like, the power of suggestion, when done right, is far greater than any complete representation, says Lane Savadov.
The magic should live inside of the audience's consciousness, not something that they look at on stage. That's the difference between, I think, the true magic of theater, which is generated by each individual audience member, versus a sort of surfacey magic, which is look at what we can do on stage. And right now, that's owned by Broadway anyway. For us, the true magic of theater is when each individual audience member mind completes the fantasy on stage. I think that's the advantage of theater, is that no matter what, we're always bumping up against budget limitations. Theater by nature is an art form that has to overcome obstacles, and those obstacles always create the best decisions.
After all, there's no fantasy without some sense of discovery.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Opera Company of Philadelphia's new production Double Bill, featuring Johnny Skeeky and L'Enfant et le Sortilège, is at the Academy of Music through May 3rd. Igor Poe's production of Bluebird by Maurice Maeterlinck opens this evening and runs through May 10th at the Mandel Theatre at Drexel University. That's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.